As of June 30, 2015, the annualized total returns for the Global Innovators Fund and MSCI World Index are as follows. For the one-year period, the fund returned 1.73% and the index returned 2.06%. For the five-year period, the fund returned 18.99% and the index returned 13.83%. For the 10-year period, the fund returned 10.76% and the index returned 7.10%. Since the fund's inception on December 15, 1998, the fund returned 7.18% and the index returned 5.39%. The gross expense ratio for the fund is 1.26%. Performance data quoted represents past performance and does not guarantee future results. The investment return and principal of an investment will fluctuate so that an investor's shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than their original cost. Current performance of the funds may be lower or higher than the performance quoted. For performance current to the most recent month end, please visit www.gafunds.com. Mutual fund investing involves risk. Principal loss is possible. Distributed by Quasar Distributors, LLC.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Guenis Atkinson Asset Management Q2 2015 conference call and webinar. All participants will be in listen-only mode. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. If you are at your computer, please submit your questions in the questions chat box located on the bottom of your webinar navigation bar, or you may submit your questions directly to trogers@dakotafunds.com. Please note this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to Mr. Matthew Page and Dr. Ian Mortimer, Portfolio Managers for Guenis Atkinson Asset Management. Gentlemen, please go ahead.
Thank you, Tracy, and thank you everyone on the line for attending this call. My name's Ian Mortimer, and I manage the Global Innovators Fund alongside my colleague, Matthew Page. Today, we're going to run you through who we are, give you an overview of what the fund is and what it aims to achieve. And then we can go on to look at how we run the portfolio and what type of companies we look to invest in. And then lastly, we'll finish by looking at the portfolio as it stands today. We'll aim to wrap this up in 20 to 25 minutes, and then we can answer any questions you might have. So firstly, who we are. Guenis Atkinson Asset Management is a global equity manager and is part of the Guenis Group of Investment Strategies. We were founded in 2002 by Tim Guenis and Jim Atkinson, who remain our CIO and CEO, respectively. Today, we have $1.1 billion assets under management in the group, and we're headquartered in both London and California. And as you can probably tell from our accents, both Matthew and I are based in London, England. We're 100% employee-owned, we're fully independent, and our sole purpose is to provide the best investment service to our clients who invest in our funds. So moving on to the strategy. The Global Innovator Strategy is a global multi-cap growth strategy with a value discipline. We aim to invest in quality growth companies at attractive valuations by employing a highly disciplined, systematic approach to stock selection and portfolio construction. We have a mid to large cap bias, and we only look at companies over $500 million of market cap at a minimum. And we run a focused portfolio of our best ideas, and that's reflected in a 30-stock equally weighted portfolio, which results in a pretty high active share. It's about greater than 95% today versus our benchmark, which is the MSCI World Index. We're very much long-term investors, and our average holding period is in the range 3 to 5 years. And we employ sensible risk and diversification rules, such as specifically we'll only own a maximum of 30% in any one industry. The fund's been running its current form since 2003, so it has over a decade of past performance, and today the strategy has just under $250 million AUM. The fund is run by myself and Matthew Page, and on page four you can just see a quick bio of the two of us. Put simply, Matthew's been working on the strategy since 2005 when he joined the firm and has been a portfolio manager since 2010. I've been at the firm since 2006 and actually been a portfolio manager on this strategy also since 2010. So we've been working together running global equity products essentially for just over 5 years now. You'll also note we're both physicists by background, but hopefully that won't put you off too much. So then the philosophy on page five. Ultimately, we believe return on capital is the best identifier of quality businesses. We either see that through, firstly, a sort of persistently above average return on capital over an entire business cycle, and that highlights companies with sort of established competitive advantages. And our analysis that we've done shows that companies who can sustain these high return on capital have a very high probability of continuing to achieve that high return on capital. Put simply, it's sort of the idea that good companies stay good. Secondly, we also look for companies with improving return on capital profiles. And that means those companies that we believe this can highlight companies with the potential to achieve above average return on capital in the future. And if this is the case, then obviously they'll have significant opportunities to reinvest their cash flows in high return projects. We also believe quality companies that can demonstrate some element of innovation, whether it be via their business model or the products they provide or service, or through sort of potentially technological advantages, will have the best chance of continuing to defend their superior return on capital. And this is an important consideration for us when we're performing our due diligence. And lastly, we believe buying companies at attractive valuations significantly increases their investment return potential over the longer term and also provides essentially a useful margin of safety to mitigate against any unforeseen risks. With that, I'd like to now pass you over to Matthew, who's going to take you through our investment process in a bit more detail before we then move on to look at how the portfolio is constructed today.
Thanks, Ian. So I think, you know, as Ian said, return on capital and value and growth are really the key criteria for what we're looking for. And you can see on this slide essentially the process we go through to funnel down to the portfolio that we own. And once we've identified this larger group of companies, we then go through a prioritization process, which is really focusing on those three points: the quality and strength of the company, the valuation, and the growth opportunities. And once we've narrowed that down to a smaller list of, say, 20 companies, we will then go away and perform our fundamental analysis on those businesses, which involves both quantitative modelling of the company over the last 15 years and also all the other qualitative factors that we need to consider. It's from that analysis that we can then come up with three options. One is to reject the company, we decide we don't like the business model for some reason. Secondly, we like the company, but we don't like the valuation, in which case it will go onto a watch list, which we can then track. Or it's an option to go into the portfolio. And ultimately, the key criteria for us there is we want to try and establish that this company has the potential to create a total return of over 50% over the next 3 years. So if we go on to the next slide, we can talk a bit more about that prioritization phase. As we mentioned, it's that business strength, valuation, and growth that we're trying to focus on at this point. So we are running screens, firstly on business strength, to try and look for companies that have got high, steady, and preferably growing return on capital, and we tend to like to use cash flow return on investment as our metric there, as opposed to return on equity. It's particularly useful for a global fund as it makes adjustments for inflation and accounting standards. Valuation is really important to us, and we think about valuation in really three ways. Firstly, what does a company's valuation look like relative to its own historical range? Secondly, in absolute terms. And finally, how does it look relative to its peer group? And then the third element is growth. And, you know, it's very easy to look at growth, but what we're really trying to identify here is companies that can grow profitably, efficient business models that don't require, say, vast amounts of working capital in order to sort of expand and grow that business. We're not looking for the companies to meet all of these criteria. That would be extremely difficult, but this is a guide as to where we want to focus our fundamental analysis. So from there, what we do is we go through a highly systematic and repeatable process. Ian and I have developed this model, which you can see a top-down view of. Over the last 5 years, we've been creating and tweaking this. And really what we're trying to do here is really get behind all the numbers of the business. It's the quantitative part of our process. So what we're doing here is looking back over 15 years of data, if we can get it, and look at how the company has evolved, how it's grown, how its margins have changed, how its working capital, its debt, and probably most importantly, how it's actually used its cash historically. How has it reinvested that cash? How has it broken that down between, say, CapEx, acquisitions, distributing cash back to shareholders, etc.? We spend quite a lot of time looking at the balance sheet, understanding the proportion of short and long-term debt and what debt they've got coming due. We look at value in those three ways here, relative to the company's history, relative to peers, and also in absolute terms. We're doing a reverse DCF. And we're also drilling into the company's dividend and dividend policy, if relevant. That's the sort of quantitative aspect of it. We then supplement that with a more qualitative approach, which is really trying to go through a sort of a checklist of all those industry-specific or stock-specific issues which won't be picked up in this quantitative approach. That's where we may then go away and try to assess the industry, talk to the management of the company, and also at the same time, you know, try to assess the growth opportunities for this business, and consider, you know, how these companies' innovation is supporting that growth, and are they at that more sort of disruptive end of the innovation spectrum, or are they more one of those more mature continuous innovators like a sort of an Intel, for example? That ultimately is going to affect the valuation that we're going to want to pay for these businesses. So on the next slide, you can see ultimately, whenever we're looking at a company, we're trying to consider where is that 50% upside going to come from. And we're trying to break that down into these two elements of the return we're going to get from growth in their cash flows, or that business value creation, if you like, and secondly, the return from the re-rating. I don't think we have ever bought a company without the prospects of a re-rating. You know, valuation, as I'll say again, is very important to us. You know, we don't buy companies trading on very high multiples with lots of expected growth, with lots of hype baked into their story. We also recognize that, you know, we're going to look at this to generate this type of return over 3 years or more, as we believe, you know, markets can be highly irrational over the short term, and we also don't believe we can necessarily predict when the market will re-rate these types of companies. I think what's also important to point out is that from this framework, you can see that we can own companies across the growth spectrum. To give you some examples, firstly, we've got Danaher here, which we describe in that sort of moderate growth category. But it has incredibly steady, high return on capital. You can see on that chart, the blue bars are the cash flow return on investment. And you can see in grey bars the asset growth. So this isn't a business that's been growing very, very rapidly, but it has got very high return on capital. And so for this sort of business, we would want to be buying it where there was more of an opportunity for a re-rating than we would for the next example, which would be a company like Netflix, which we own from 2007 through 2010. This obviously was a company going through a rapid growth phase. Return on capital was growing, and the asset growth was really quite marked. So, as I said, we never buy a company without expecting some kind of a re-rating, but for this type of company, we're really expecting more of it to come from generating ever-increasing economic profits over the near term. So hopefully that gives you a good sense of what type of companies we are going to own. And really it is those three pillars that we bring it back to. You know, quality through its return on capital profile, valuation in those three ways I described, and then those profitable growth opportunities going forward. So I'll hand it back over to Ian now to talk through, you know, how we construct the portfolio and how the portfolio looks today.
Thanks, Matthew. On page 12 you can just quickly see, or just a recap of our portfolio construction and risk controls. As we mentioned, it's a 30-stock portfolio. It's one-in, one-out policy. We equally weight those positions, so typically they're in this 3-4% level. It's well diversified globally and across industry. This is a global equity product, domestic in an international, and we'll have a maximum of 30% in any one industry. We very much run this on a bottom-up process, but we like to use what we describe as a common sense approach to sort of risk awareness. So we're very much sort of benchmark aware rather than benchmark driven, and we're always trying to sort of assess concentration risks in the portfolio versus, you know, what we see is going on in the current macro environment. But moving on to the actual portfolio, as you can see on the next slide, and what we've done is we've split it up into the sort of some sort of growth buckets. You can see the first bucket we describe as sort of 0 to 10%, and this is long-term growth rates we're looking at. The second is that sort of 10 to 20%, and then lastly, that sort of 20% plus, so sort of very high growth. And I think what this shows you is it gives you quite a good indication about the types of growth and valuations that we have in the strategy. And generally speaking, we'll have the majority of the portfolio in the 0 to 10 and 10 to 20% buckets. And you can see in that chart that historically we've never really had much more than about a fifth of the portfolio in that sort of 20% plus growth. And you can see today we only own 3% in the company PTC. I would also note, though, you know, over time that we own companies, we do reassess what those long-term growth profiles will be. So something like a Gilead, you know, we bought maybe 4 years ago, when we first bought it, would have been in that 20% plus growth bucket, and then as it's evolved over time, we can reassess where it sits. And I think the reflection I mentioned in terms of the value discipline is really to say that, you know, we don't want to pay up too much for expected growth. And a fund, because we find that, you know, this often doesn't materialize. And typically, you know, we find companies with 20% plus growth prospects are often highly valued by the market and therefore make up less of our portfolio. But if we can find those opportunities, we're very willing to buy them. And today we find that actually, you know, in today's sort of investable universe we're looking at, that those types of companies have become even more fully valued. And it's that, you know, and what I would say is it's very unlikely for you to see, you know, us consider companies which have multiples of earnings that are more than, you know, 50, 60, 70, 100 times, and not something we're particularly interested in terms of our portfolio. Moving on then to page 14, I think that sort of neatly brings us to the actual portfolio profile today. And here you can see the companies we own. We've grouped it by industry, and we've given you a little bit more information about some of those companies. The thing I'd say is you can see in terms of the industry breakdown, our largest weight today is about 19% of the portfolio, and that's the capital goods, where we've seen quite good value in some of the more industrial names such as Danaher or Roper, and some of the more manufacturing type names like Boeing. We also see quite good prospects across the broad sort of information technology sector, where we have it reasonably well diversified across the three groups of semiconductors, which is about 12% of the portfolio, 16% in sort of software and services, and 12% to more the sort of technology and hardware and equipment companies. You'll also note that, you know, we see potentially better value in some of the more larger cap names in these industries today, and that third column, which is market cap, sort of highlights that, and the market cap there is given in US dollars, billions. What you can also see at the bottom of that page is the median market cap and the average market cap. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, the median market cap today is just under $32 billion, whereas if you look up the names in that column, you'll see that we have over 30% of the portfolio in companies that actually trade at less than $20 billion. So I think it is a reflection that, you know, we do run this as a multi-cap portfolio, which is more mid and large cap biased, and we're certainly not looking at small cap names. The percentage of NAV column, the third from the right, shows you that, you know, the equally weighted nature. And again, I think it just highlights that we're not mechanically trading that to be exactly 3.33% day in, day out. We very much recognize the cost of trading and churn. And we want to keep those trading costs to an absolute minimum. So we're very happy for companies in terms of their value in the portfolio to move around. And we typically sort of rebalance the portfolio more on a sort of quarterly type basis, or when we get inflows and outflows into the portfolio to actively move in and top up or reduce specific stocks. The last thing I'll mention on this, and I think for us is one of the most interesting elements, is if you look at the bottom right of that chart on page 14, in red you can see a line that says total portfolio. What this is showing you is the multiple that this portfolio is trading based on 2015 expected earnings. That's 15.1 times, and 2016 expected earnings, which is 13.7 times. And this is driven by Bloomberg consensus estimates. So what that shows you is underneath is the MSCI World Index on the same basis is actually trading on 17.2 times 2015 earnings, and 15.3 times 2016 earnings. So that shows the portfolio today is actually on a discount of 12% this year's earnings and over 10% next year. And we think that's actually quite compelling relative to the sort of good quality companies we own that actually have still reasonable growth prospects. So moving on then to page 15 and our sell discipline. Again, we try and have a reasonably systematic approach to this. And put simply, it's checking our current holdings systematically to ensure that they continue to meet our criteria that we were looking for originally. So firstly, is if that deterioration of the business quality, that return on capital profile deteriorates, or the balance sheet becomes stretched, we are not looking to invest in overly leveraged companies. The valuation is very key for us, so if that upside, downside, it becomes less compelling, we may exit the position. If the growth opportunities or the profitable growth opportunities seem lacking, whether that's from an industry, economic, or company perspective. And then lastly, our original reason for purchase no longer holds. So we are willing to sort of cut our losses if we were incorrect. And then obviously we get new ideas. Again, we run a one-in-one-out portfolio, and if we get a compelling idea, then obviously we can remove something from the portfolio. In terms of what we've actually done, you can see the buys and sells that we have made over the last 5 years, split into calendar years. And it just goes to highlight that sort of average holding period of sort of, or turnover of that sort of 15 to 25% per year. And I think this highlights two things. The first is that we really do only make changes to the portfolio if we generally have better ideas. So you see in 2012 that we didn't do very much to the portfolio, for example. And also, number two is that we will sell companies faster than our 3 to 5 year holding period if the valuation comes into range more quickly than we might have expected. So examples there would be in 2011, we bought Apple, we saw a very large re-rating in the market, and then we sold it into 2012, the company had moved maybe 60 or 70%. Or from a slightly different perspective, we bought Shire in the back end of 2013, and we sold that into 2014, with less than a year's holding because the bid by ASI came in. Pleasingly, we exited that before the bid went away. Page 17 just shows you the standardized performance chart or table for the Global Innovators Fund versus the MSCI World Index, its benchmark. And what I would do is just highlight just the significant long-term outperformance of the fund, which is what we really look at. We think stacks up quite well over all of 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years. And you'll note that we've done the annualized performance there. I'll also just highlight the risk disclaimer at the bottom of this page. So then lastly, I would just bring you on to a continuation of looking at that performance, but maybe in a slightly different way. And I think what this shows is the top chart, the line graph, is showing our cumulative performance, total return in US dollars, since the end of 2003. Along with the calendar year performance below it. And I think what this highlights is, or usefully highlights, is how the fund has typically historically performed in different markets. So firstly, that you can see in very sharply falling markets, such as 2008 or 2011, the fund has underperformed slightly, whereas in significantly or sharply rising markets, the fund has actually outperformed by quite a lot. So in markets such as 2009, 2012 or 13 or even 14 for that matter. So to sum up, I would just say, the strategy of the Global Innovators Fund is to focus on quality companies with profitable growth opportunities at attractive valuations, and we try and provide that to you in a concentrated high active share portfolio that we know today is offering a very compelling discount to the broad market. So with that, I'll just leave you with the disclosure page, and I'd like to thank you from both myself and Matthew for taking the time to listen to this presentation and consider our fund. And with that, I'll pass the call back to Tracy, and we will answer any questions if there are any.
Great. Thank you so much, Ian and Matt, for all of your comments this afternoon. And we'll now open it up for Q&A. Again, as a friendly reminder for our audience, if you are at your computer, please submit your questions in the questions chat box, or you may email them to trogers@dakotafunds.com. First question for you, what is your typical portfolio breakdown between U.S. and non-U.S. stocks?
Okay, great. Thanks for that. Typically, if we just look historically, obviously we can look at the portfolio breakdown going back over a decade. That's been probably portfolio's been somewhere between 50 and 70% exposure to the US. Today it is around just over 70%. And typically the balance, the difference, has been split pretty much evenly between sort of Asia and Europe. We have not, you know, the fund really looks at sort of developed markets and emerging markets, and we do not really consider sort of what we describe as frontier markets. So today, so historically, you should think 50 to 70% US, the balance in Asia and Europe roughly equally split.
Great, thank you, Ian. Next question, sticking with the portfolio, why do you equally weight the portfolio?
Okay, so the reason behind this is essentially down to the fact that we want this process that we have to be generating the returns. We don't want to be taking large stock-specific risks on our latest best idea, because we think you know, that can lead you down to thinking your latest idea is your best idea, whereas actually, you know, some of those great ideas you had a few months ago are equally as good, but just the market hasn't caught up with that rationale yet. We don't want to put, you know, big bets into just a few individual stocks. Also, the advantage of it is that, you know, you're obviously limiting your stock-specific risk. You know, if one of our company was to go completely wrong, we obviously can't lose more than 3%. And the other great effect of it is the rebalancing process. Obviously, through time, if one sector goes on a particularly strong run, we can take some profits out of the companies we own in those companies, rebalance them down to 3% and put them into the companies that we like in a sector that over the short term has been more out of favor. So we're really trying to sort of protect ourselves from behavioral biases, but also exploit those that are exhibited in the market by short-term fluctuations and trends.
Matt, thank you so much. Next question. What has been the turnover in the portfolio year to date, and is that in line with previous years?
Yeah, so as we saw earlier, the portfolio turnover is relatively low from year to year. So far this year, we've made one change. We've literally just made that change, so I can't say who it is, what it is yet. But I think generally the way you should think about it is if you see a rapid re-rating in a market in a year, we're going to have more opportunities to take companies out of the portfolio due to the fact they will have hit our valuation targets. And in more sort of benign environments, you know, we may end up doing less. And I would say sort of 70 to 80% of all the decisions that we make in terms of the sell discipline tend to be valuation-led.
Thank you again, and I know you both spent some time discussing the process in which you create the portfolio. And going back to the inception of the strategy, has that process changed, if at all?
No. It's, you know, going back to, you know, when the fund was since Guinness Atkinson has been running the fund since 2003, the process has remained exactly the same. It's always been a 30 stock equal weighted portfolio, looking for reasonably priced growth companies with low turnover. And it's been a very sort of considered approach that we've won, and one we found that's worked successfully. So we've been not likely to change it, I suppose. So I think I guess that was a long answer. The short answer is no, it hasn't changed.
Thanks very much, Ian. And one more question for you both. Do you buy any IPOs?
Generally speaking, we don't. We certainly haven't bought any IPOs in the period that Ian and I have been running the fund over the last 5 or 6 years. I think generally our view on IPOs, and particularly at the moment, is that their valuations tend to come out at pretty excessive points. And they can often go and get more expensive after that. But what I think we tend to see, and certainly what we try to identify, is often there are great companies coming to market. It's just the valuations we don't like, but they go through a kind of a hype cycle, if you like. And so what we're trying to do is wait for these companies these great companies with great businesses and great models, for that sentiment to slightly turn more negative. Maybe the industry doesn't quite meet up to the expectations that investors were hoping for, and it then becomes a sort of interesting potential entry point. I think a good example of that maybe at the moment is, the sort of 3D printing area where the market got very excited about that 2-3 years ago, and actually now we're seeing that growth hasn't come through at the high expected rate that the market was pricing in at that point. And potentially there is some more sort of interesting entry points, on the horizon.
Matt, thank you so much. And that looks like it concludes our Q&A session for today. And I would just like to turn the conference call back over to the two of you for any closing remarks.
Okay, thanks, Tracy. I think we just conclude by saying it's been a pleasure giving the presentation today. I hope it was useful and informative. And as ever, if anyone has any further questions or interest in the fund or the strategy, Matt and I are always more than happy to take questions offline and talk you through any other questions you have. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you again to Ian and Matt for your time this afternoon, and thank you to our audience for your participation. The conference has now concluded, and again, thank you for attending, and you may now disconnect your phone lines.